This episode is about minutes 11 through 15 of The Empire Strikes Back, which starts with Luke staggering out of the Wampa's gorge and ends with Han making them a very smelly Tauntaun sleeping bag. Hello there, and welcome to Star Wars Music Minute, where we celebrate the music and sound of Star Wars 5 cinematic minutes at a time. I'm Chrysanthi Tan, but you can call me Xanthi, and today is all about minutes 11 through 15 of Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. In these minutes, we have Luke, of course, exiting the gorge, getting onto the snowy plain. Luke also sees a vision of Ben Kenobi, and then Han finds the collapsed Luke in the snow, and they sleep inside of a Tauntaun for the night. And today's guest is Jake Gile. Wait. Gile. Yeah.
That's it?
Gile. Yeah, that's right. Whom I am very excited to talk to. We were, I guess, very recent colleagues at the Rubin Institute for Music Criticism, where we had a very boot camp of a week, watching concerts and writing reviews overnight, very sleepless. So I don't think we've ever spoken to each other with, you know, a good night of sleep under our belt, but I'm glad we're here today.
Me too. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I have to say that I don't know that I've ever met anybody before who can tolerate me talking about Star Wars music ad nauseum, let alone inviting me to do so. So this is quite literally a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Well, I'm sure it won't be the last. it's funny because when, like, even before we went to Rubin Institute, which for listeners who don't know, Rubin Institute is, I guess, it's like a every other year music criticism workshop where they choose like 15 people around the country, I guess around North America. You know, I guess we're like promising music critics, they say. I don't know. And then we have this very, I don't know, we get to study with critics and, I don't know, meet each other and talk about music and learn, you know, how to better discuss music, which is obviously something I very much like to do and something that Jake likes to do as well as, a musician and scholar himself. But heading there, one of my goals was like, there's got to be at least someone at this program that is going to be a Star Wars fan, and I'm going to get them on my show. I'm going to get them. I want to definitely ask everyone, and I did. I would go around at lunch saying, hey, do you like Star Wars? Do you like Star Wars? And there were two of you out of the whole cohort, and that's why you're here. Yes.
There should have been more, but I'm glad to be the chosen few.
So how do you feel about The Empire Strikes Back music?
Well, okay, I want to say, first of all, that I think probably The Empire Strikes Back is my favorite of the trilogy. Of course, I love really all of the music, at least especially from the first six, but I really, really love how during the second movie you get so much of the development of the musical themes alongside the developments in the trilogy, because, like, you know, A New Hope is great, but it's also so much of a setup, and here you really get to be thrust into the arc of the epic.
Yeah, and The Empire Strikes Back really offers something different than A New Hope does musically. I mean, same composer, there are a lot of, you know, the same themes or like leitmotifs that crop up, but overall the like distribution of music throughout scenes is very different, you know, probably because of the difference in director, you know, no small part. But yeah, I am really excited to be going through The Empire Strikes Back 5 minutes at a time because, well, already there's so much to chew in it. There's a lot of ways to slice. There are many ways to slice the music in this score. Like, we can talk about atonal, like, stuff, like rhythm, pacing. There's extended techniques. Like, there's so many extended techniques, like in the strings and winds and everything. It's a lot. It's very...
Definitely. And also the stuff that isn't, like, strictly speaking, musical, right? Lots of really awesome Foley work and
Definitely.
Sort of an interesting integration of like atmospheric sounds and musical sounds, especially in this clip, is a great one to talk about.
Absolutely. That. Yes. They are very, they work together really, really well. Let's actually start listening to this clip so we can get into it.
Come on, give me a sign here.
Okay. So this is the tail end of the previous cue. Just kidding. I started too late in the clip. Okay, let's start over. Okay, here we go. This is the tail end of the previous cue. I was like, why is Han in there? That little brass stinger. So here, obviously, we have the howling wind. And we're about to have almost 3 minutes of no music. It's just the barren, but very loud still. Like, it's not quiet. There's no music, but it's certainly not quiet.
You must come along now, R2. There's really nothing more we can do. And my joints are freezing up. Don't say things like that. Of course we'll see Master Luke again. And he'll be quite all right. You'll see. Stupid little short circuit. He'll be quite all right.
Droids. Right
good
off
the, stuff.
Good stuff. And right off the bat, I do want to say that according to Ben Burt, the motors, like the sound of 3PO walking and moving about, you know, how loud his movements are. They bought a door from an old Cadillac Eldorado, which had the motors in the door that operated the window up and down. And they used that window motor for 3PO walking.
So, oh, I love that.
Pretty creative.
And I love when he's moving around, like his little jerky movements that are occurring while he's speaking. And it's like, it's almost too loud. It's almost obtrusive, but not quite.
Yeah. And I can't help but notice the parallel between this moment and In A New Hope when they land on Tatooine and 3PO also is complaining about his joints. So... I guess that's a
common. We have that in common.
It's recurring. Yes, I get it, 3PO. Especially if I were on Hoth, I think I would just be aching all over all the time. So 3PO is keeping them, at least the droid has some real needs here. So, window motor of a Cadillac.
Super cool.
Yeah, very cool. And here, okay, now we're almost a minute into the clip and we still just have the sound design. So this is Luke. It cuts back to Luke and he's struggling to stay upright. He collapses in the snow. So originally there actually was music that John Williams wrote for this whole part, but Irving Kirshner, yeah, asked him to cut it out or just cut it out. And it was like actually really dramatic music. It was very, I don't want to say overscored because that's just in contrast to what we have now. And so I'm used to what we have now, but it was just a lot more prescriptive, descriptive.
All patrols are in. Still no contact from Skywalker Solo.
Mistress Leia, R2...
Gotta love the sound mixing there where it's very worldized, so it's not like the crisp, clear audio that you sometimes hear in movies now, and that's like kind of one of my pet peeves about sort of newer Star Wars movies and shows is that the dialogue all sounds way too crisp from a booth, but this sounds like it's in a base, like in a warehouse, in a base. And I
yeah,
love
it's
that.
Like almost if you've ever had the experience where you're trying to say something kind of private in public, but you're in a room that's really boomy. And so you say something and you realize that it like went way further than you meant it to. And that's exactly what happens, right? Because it's this like very boomy sound. And Leia is kind of sitting off to the corner. And they're essentially saying that hope is lost for poor dear Luke. And they realize suddenly that they're speaking out of turn in front of somebody who is quite invested in his existence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who says he's been quite unable to pick up any signals, although he does admit that his own range is far too weak to abandon all hope.
Your Highness, there's nothing more we can do tonight. The shield doors must be closed.
And so here it's all about Leia's body language.
Close the doors.
Yes, sir.
We don't hear it in any dialogue, but Arthur, she just nods.
The chances of survival are 725-1.
Oh, that door sound.
Scary.
It's so ominous. It's like shutting down. It's like closing hope. Okay, we're leading
Actually,
up.
R2 has been known to make mistakes. From time to time.
That pause.
Dear.
Beautiful.
And the restraint in not using music here is pretty.
I'm sure he'll be all right.
Is pretty amazing.
For a human being.
Now we're about to get music. Finally. And so that's kind of like typical sort of, you can tell it's transition music. Like the harp kind of does its glissando. Yeah. And we have that like somber horn, stinger chord, you know, like, and then the wind takes us.
I couldn't quite tell, but I think it's kind of like the adagio in Beethoven's Seventh, where the bass note is not actually the root of the chord. So it gives you this like, it's a pretty normal chord, right? But it gives you this really, really unsettled feeling. Like it's like somebody raising an eyebrow musically, like what's gonna happen? You know what I mean?
That's a good point. Let's hear that again. I know you're talking about Beethoven's Seventh. You're talking about the second movement.
Oh, the Allegretto, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. He's quite clever, you know, for a human being.
Is it maybe in second inversion?
Yeah, which is exactly in the Beethoven. It's an A minor chord with the E in the bass, which is bizarre. Bizarre way to start a movement.
You're totally right. Yeah, as soon as you say that, I feel it in my like muscle I feel it in my memory, in my body. I know what you're talking about. Yeah, you're right. It because it doesn't just sound like. And I think the order. I think the order of the notes in a chord. You know, the inversion, if you will, or just the voicing of things can make such a big difference. And especially putting something in like, the C would be like the C sharp would be like the fifth. Putting that in the bottom feels like the most, it's not unusual, but it's the most disorienting for me sometimes. It's not disorienting, but it's just like, I don't know, it feels different than just a standard triad.
When you're introducing a new thought, especially, and when like the music's just beginning again, you expect to be grounded in something. And this completely robs you of that feeling. You feel very vulnerable and exposed and uncertain. You know, it's like stepping into quicksand or something.
Yeah, the grounding is, I think, the key word there. So I guess, so we'll pay attention to the next time we hear that sort of horn, somber chord. By the way, this corresponds to 429 of The Wampa's Lair / Vision of Obi-Wan / Snowspeeders Take Flight, which is a track on the Empire Strikes Back Special Edition soundtrack. So, I also believe it is on the regular version of the soundtrack, or the one that's on Spotify, in The Heroics of Han and Luke. I think that's the name of it. But in any case, this is also Q2M2, Ben's instructions. So we will keep listening.
Luke.
You hear that tiny, that really minuscule sounding string, like glissando up to the highest note.
Ben?
The Force theme.
You will go to the Dagobah system.
Dagobah.
the system.
There you will learn from Yoda.
But you don't get the whole thing.
Or it's fragmented.
Man.
Oh, man. Okay, let's talk about that. Oh, what are your thoughts?
I love that. I mean, I was thinking about sort of how to interpret that in a couple of different ways, because you really do only get the first half of the leitmotif ending kind of in a way that you expect the rest of it to go. But I had two possible interpretations for that. One is sort of Luke's vulnerability, but I think more than that, it's the way in which he's not quite yet connected to the Force fully, right? Like, he just had that episode where he sort of struggles to pull the lightsaber out of the snow because he hasn't quite got the hang of it yet. And also, this is where Ben's about to encourage him to go see Yoda, which is kind of where he really learns about the Force for the first time in detail. And it just sort of shows his immaturity. Like, obviously the Force is strong within him, but there's no development cultivation of the kind of existential state you need to be in to harness that.
Yeah, I feel that, because the Force theme kind of springs out of, you know, like when you have like a petri dish full of like random stuff, and sometimes, I don't know, I'm not a scientist, so please don't attack me in the comments. Stuff kind of springs out, like life can kind of spring out of unexpected places sometimes, or like things will sprout. Okay, this doesn't have to involve a petri dish, so scratch that part. But, you know, things can grow out of unexpected places sometimes, but things flourish much better if you know how to actually cultivate the soil and like have a solid like base for the things that you want to grow to happen, you know, kind of more intentionally. And here, it's not like we have, like, the Force theme is not emerging out of a very solid like tonal base or anything like that, or even rhythmically. Like, it's not very confident, it's not very assured, it's not how we hear the Force theme in other places. It's kind of springing out of this very sparse, like, you know, some instruments doing like kind of random things. They're not random necessarily. They're not random. Like, I don't think, yeah, I don't want to say that they're random, but they sound very sparse, and like, what can emerge out of this? And that's kind of what it reminds me of. Like, I don't know, the Force theme, it's still there, but it's not a very strong signal at all.
Yeah, I really like the use of the word emerging, because you almost get the sense that, especially because the sound of the Force theme and of the score is competing with the sound of the wind of the snowstorm, that it's almost as though there's music going on the whole time. You just can't hear it because there's this din of circumstance of the environment, the completely inhospitable environment that Luke's in. And so it's like he's struggling to cling on to life, to hear the Force, to observe the power of life in himself. And ultimately it kind of gets obscured, right? It can't continue. And he collapses just before the next clip, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, I like to hear how the other instruments are sort of, they are making an effort. You know, it's kind of like, here's another analogy, like rubbing sticks together to try to make fire. And you might not have the right, like, know the, like, it's sort of like rubbing number two pencils together. Like, that's what they're trying to do here. And their attempts are consistent within themselves, but just they don't really light the match quite, you know, strongly. Like, let's listen back. So I'm thinking of what happens before the Force theme. So the flutes are going like, But they're doing it over and over again. That's like their thing.
You will go to the Dagobah system.
Dagobah system.
If we zero in on the clarinets as well, they have their thing.
Lou.
Ben?
You will go to the Dagobah system.
And the strings have their, like, tremolo. There's the flutes again.
Yoda, the Jedi Master who instructed me.
We have some brass jumping in with mutes. And we have the harp going up and down. They're like trying. They're trying something. And then here, obviously, there's a big shift.
Don't do this, Luke. Come on, give me a sign here.
I love that shift there.
Yeah, where kind of Han breaks the spell of the situation, right? Like, there's a vision, an apparition of Ben, and then reality kicks in. Mr. Reality, Mr. Mr. The Force is a load of malarkey.
Yeah, the lightsaber is only good for cutting off in a tauntaun. yeah, it's a glorified knife. That's, I think, the way that you just described it, that is almost like exactly like what I have in my notes as well, which is the part where Luke is seeing Ben is like the mirage, and all of the musical elements that kind of make it seem like it's floating, like it's not grounded, like especially the harp going up and down and, you know, that kind of thing. And then back to reality, just like you said. And the thing that actually gets us right back to reality is another one of those brass chords. So let's hear that whole thing again, just because. So here's the mirage, right? It's like wispy. It's hard to even get a sense of like what the tempo is. Celeste.
You will go to the Dagobah system.
Dagobah system.
There you will learn from Yoda, the Jedi Master who instructed me.
Ben!
And the violins just double that note. Brass chord.
Luke! Luke!
More motion, his Pio Mosso, as Han kicks into gear. Each one
dramatic.
Increments. Yeah, exactly. Each one increments a little bit in.
Give me a sign here.
And that perfect fifth kind of, it's just a perfect fifth, but it kind of could also be a little trying to get a signal of the Luke's theme. Doo-doo-doo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or not.
I love these little like clusters of like liggety, spectralist, really kind of dissonant bits that are interacting with the wind sound. You kind of got that at the beginning too, right? Where like the very first thing you hear are these strings doing like what in any sort of late romantic illustrative music piece would represent wind or, you know, a tempest or something like that. And it just, it hands it over to what you're hearing in the environment. And they're not competing with each other. They're very much complementary.
Yeah, that's it is kind of spectralist. Can you define what you mean by spectralist?
I guess what I mean is, yeah, instead of privileging something like a harmony within the context of a melody or the other way around, spectralism for me, I guess an easy definition is maybe more of a focus on timbre, right? Timbre being the thing that differentiates me knocking on a piece of metal versus, you know, knocking on a piece of wood or something, sort of the thing that allows you to differentiate between two sounds independent of its pitch. Different sounds interacting with each other in ways that, like, if you tried to analyze them harmonically would make no sense, create really cool effects when you just bunch them together. Maybe not altogether pleasant effects all the time, but really kind of punchy or dreamy or, you know, there's a universe of possibilities, probably more possibilities than in just kind of traditional standard practice.
Yeah.
Harmony.
Yeah. I'd say like spectral music, like focuses is very like acoustics based and gets very detailed about those textures, which I think acoustic orchestral instruments, one of the things that I really like about the Empire Strikes Back score is that there are moments that really use like the full range of what like acoustic instruments can do. Because it's not just about like being able to play a very solid melody or something. Like we have so many things that sound like they're on the cusp of sound design, and those are also made by instruments. And so spectral music can sound very wind-like sometimes.
And then on the other hand, you have this kind of bizarre, well, what would have been a bizarre sound of this big lush string sound, right? Like by the 70s and the 80s, audiences would have really construed that kind of sound, a big orchestra, this big, you know, romantic sound, as something very old fashioned, something coming from like the golden age of Hollywood in the 40s and 50s, Max Steiner, composers like that. And so it's very striking to have, as you said, like the forefront of experimental music almost. And then at the same time, this very old school classic string sound. And I think what the result is that together it creates something that's like, by covering all times at once, it becomes timeless.
Yes. Yes. I almost wish that more film scores kind of followed in that sort of tradition, or at least were willing to develop in those ways as well. And what I mean is that like the late romantic classical period, or, you know, the late romantic period is what really became the basis for that old school Hollywood film sound. And then it's not like film music imitated or followed suit with the way that classical music kept on developing. It sort of stayed in that late romantic, inspiration, and then just like maximized the elements that made late romantic music appealing in the first place. So film music sort of kept developing in sort of a very hyper romantic way. And with, you know, few examples, didn't really continue much further. It developed in a different path. Like, you know, this is not a value judgment. It just continued in a different path and then followed more of the computer music, you know, followed more of the electronic music side of things. And then the utility of using samples and DAWs, computers and whatever, all that kind of stuff. It just sort of developed in a different vein. But I think this is why, like, growing up, I didn't listen to very much film music because it sounded to me, most of it, like kind of a more stilted version of classical music that was, you know, could sound late romantic, but also way more. I don't know if that makes sense.
Totally. No, it totally makes sense.
Yeah. But here we actually do have, you know, almost like Grisez could have worked on it or something. Okay. So if we continue along, love that tauntaun. So this is the tauntaun collapsed. now you have some tempo pushing a little bit.
Not much time. Ben.
And the strings are like tootie. They're like...
Hang on, kid.
This escalating oboe line.
This may smell bad, kid. But it'll keep you warm. Till I get the shelter up.
Ben.
Wind.
I thought they smelled bad. On the outside.
This trumpet solo. And that's the end of the minutes.
I gotta say that I find this sonically a pretty compelling section, with the exception of Mark Hamill, of Luke. His Ben, Jacob assistant. Ben, it really kind of lowers the gravitas of the entire situation a little bit. I love the films. They're dear to my heart. But I think we can all admit that sometimes maybe that the acting and the dialogue could use a little work.
I agree, but also I don't have a clear, I can't look at it clearly because it's so part of me that I cannot be objective about it at all.
Totally agree. Totally. It's like my childhood, you know, I mean, it's a part of who I am.
Yeah. So there are some things where I'm like, okay, yeah, I can see how that's cheesy, but you better not change it. That's how it is. Don't touch it. especially when things have become like memeified and just, yeah.
Oh yeah. Gotta do it for the memes.
Yeah. So here we have a visual of Han. Is this the only time he's used a lightsaber? I'm not sure, but it's possible. And I just have to say, like, the colors on Hoth, the colors in this film really are so striking. This whole thing is quite a mood. We have some guts. Sorry, content warning.
Yum.
We have some guts there. That was a very impactful like scene for me as a child as well. Just seeing those like spill out, like, whoa.
Imagining the smell. You can smell it. Like, you know, something comes to mind when you see that and hear Han retching.
And you hear the squish. But yeah, it's pretty great stuff. Every time I rewatch a Star Wars film, especially the original trilogy, because I feel like that's probably the trilogy. I don't know. I haven't revisited the original trilogy in a deep way since childhood, teenage years. Until I did this podcast, because I sort of would always watch the prequels, like when I wanted to see Star Wars. And I don't know why, like maybe I just took the originals for granted that they're there, but the prequels to me always felt fun and sort of, you know, childhood as well. But I have much more appreciation for Empire Strikes Back as an adult compared to as a kid when I thought some of the slowness was boring. But this Hoth stuff is very spaced out, gives a lot of time to not have emotions sort of like fed down our throats, I guess. And it's quite contrasting to A New Hope, which is much more clear in its emotional direction. So.
Yeah, it's almost like the visual element matches the sparseness of the sound. It was interesting that you said earlier that much of this had been through composed and then that was sort of reneged, because I think the silence is really effective. Like we tend to think of music as something that's really, really dramatic, just like we tend to think of color as something that's really dramatic. But in both cases, the sonic silence or the visual mutedness of how many gradients of black, white, gray can you get out of something is a really interesting expressive range.
Yeah, I'm going to actually play some of the original music that was composed for this, which you can find on the special edition of this album, and it's the track The Wampa's Lair, Vision of Obi-Wan, that whole thing, Snowspeeders Take Flight. So yeah, most of the first, like half of it, is what was originally composed for the quiet, the part that's now quiet. All of this cut. But he was composing his ass off. Minor main theme. Which, good thing they got to use that later on in the magic tree.
Stravinsky!
Totally. All of this cut, yep. It's like, see, it's so much more active. And instead we have just silence, or no music. Which I think takes a lot of like directorial vision to be willing to turn this music down. There's so much of it. So now we're leading into... Anyway, there's quite a bit of music that got cut there.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, it's great. It's great stuff, but there's nothing really particularly cohesive about it, right? I mean, there's a couple of themes that pop up again. You mentioned the minor main theme, which I totally agree is like way more effective when it happens later on, the Dagobah system, but yeah, no, that would be a completely different scene. It's good stuff. I'm glad they cut it.
Yeah, same. And John Williams is such a team player. He handles that stuff pretty well, and we get it still on the soundtrack anyway, so it's all fine in the end. But yeah, it's. It definitely, I like when a director knows what they want from the music. And so this is a clear example. I mean, we have The Empire Strikes Back.
I would be curious to go back and find how much silence there is in the film. Because it really wasn't anything I thought about until you sent me the clip. Because I said, oh no, like I was looking at my watch and I think I counted like a minute 45 seconds of music out of the 5 minutes or something. I was like, okay, well, what is there to talk about then? But a lot. There's a lot to talk about. And like you said, there's other aspects of the sound other than music that are definitely worth looking into. But it's definitely not something I had considered before this that Star Wars would contain moments of sparse sound.
Yeah. I think we're going to get a lot more this season. I And again, I don't know off the top of my head, but I'll be finding out in real time, week to week, or, you know, whenever I prepare for each episode. Okay, so one thing that I started doing this season, and I'm about to run the clip now, is that listeners, I don't know if this by this point I will have a name for this segment yet, but basically I have these little quick segments of, I don't know, light education sort of to help I need a name for this clip. I will have a name for the end by the end of the season, I swear. But basically just like little tips to help you, especially if you don't have like a formal music training or whatever, consider music that you don't immediately know how to analyze, or just, you know, ways to think about music. And that's a really horrible intro, but I'm gonna play the clip. And today's topic is tempo. And then there will be some examples from The Empire Strikes Back. So I'm just gonna run that quick clip, and then it'll go back to the normal episode. Tempo refers to the speed or pace of music, but it's not just about BPM. In Western classical music, there are many ways to describe tempo that offer more expressive information. For example, andante means at a walking pace. Grave means slow and solemn, while adagio means slow and stately. Presto means very fast, while allegro means fast and happy. These are just a few of the most common tempo terms. While there are rough ranges for how fast these respective markings should map to in BPM, mood takes precedence. For example, a composer wouldn't write allegro if they wanted something to sound angry, even if their desired tempo fell within the same range as allegro. They would find a different way to describe it, perhaps agitato or furioso. There's no rule that Italian has to be used, by the way. There are just many ways to describe tempo. Some of my favorite tempo terms are the ones that describe changes or provide extra detail about the mood or character of said tempo. For example, accelerando means accelerating in pace. It's sort of the time-based version of crescendo, which means growing in volume. Rallentando or ritardando means slowing down. Other flavors of that include molto rallentando, slow down a lot, and poco rallentando, slowing down a little. Adding subito to a tempo indication means that the change happens suddenly. Più mosso means more motion than what came before. Meno mosso means less motion than what came before. Ad libitum means at one's leisure or free tempo. And there's also rubato, which means robbed in Italian and refers to a free-flowing pulse where it's acceptable to steal or borrow time from other places and make up for it. Tempo rubato often sounds like it's pushing and pulling in a very flexible manner. On the other side of the coin, there's tempo alla marcia, which means as a march, and denotes not only a marching pace, but also a strictness of tempo. The strictness of the tempo is the more salient point here, more so than the actual BPM range, which is roughly 90 to 120 BPM, give or take. In The Empire Strikes Back, the Imperial March is in tempo alla marcia. Note how strict the pulse is. We'll hear a contrasting example in a few seconds. A tempo indicates a return to the baseline tempo, usually after a period of slowing down or speeding up. You may be wondering why this would even matter if you're not composing or reading off of sheet music yourself. And it's true that when we're just listening to music, we don't know for sure which tempo markings are indicated in the score. But the words themselves are not what really matter. I think having an understanding of the myriad ways that composers and musicians even conceive of pacing possibilities can unlock an extra layer of your musical perception. It can also ruin you a little bit once you start noticing how monotonous the pacing is in so many film and TV scores. Luckily, the pacing in The Empire Strikes Back is anything but monotonous, so I'll play a final example to demonstrate John Williams's flexible use of tempo and pacing. This is from the final scene of the movie.
All right, breathe. 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, molto rallentando, this huge slowdown, a tempo, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, molto rallentando, subito presto, 4, 1, 2.
So good. That music is so good.
That was awesome. I love that.
Thank you.
That's a phenomenal explanation.
Oh, thank you.
There's no possible way I could have ever done better.
Oh, well, Well, I appreciate that. I hope that made sense to people listening. And as always, if you have something that you, if there are terms that come up in episodes that you don't understand, even if they seem very, very basic, but they're kind of holding you back from getting further into the conversations, please let me know. Nothing is too silly or too basic. I would love to know because I really, you know, this whole show is not just so quote unquote experts can just talk to each other about stuff that the rest of people don't understand. Like I want everyone to feel like this is accessible knowledge, information, ways to perceive and, I don't know, analyze music on your own, because anyone can analyze music. You don't have to be a musician. Period.
It's a fact.
Yep. All right.
I think the more music education you get, the more you learn that you're just pretty much finding a lot of three-syllable words for stuff you already knew.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of, in a way, it's like validating, and for that reason, and for good and bad, like it can be validating in a way that stunts you from like accepting other perceptions that other people have. And I understand when people sort of want to hear a quote unquote music theory explanation of something, because I think a lot of people want to hear their ideas, their feelings about things, like sort of validated by complex language or some frameworks that have already been like tested and discussed by scholars or whatnot. But so much of the time, like people's spidey sense, like feelings that they just have, are already correct, are already exactly on the right track.
Absolutely. That was my favorite part, I think, of your tempo explanation, was that like I can sit here, I have this like old fashioned metronome that probably too small to read, but I can move this dial. So, you know, here's a largo. Or, you know, something like that. It has all these numbers. It looks very mathematical. And it's not nearly as important as the way that it makes you feel. And I think you're so right on. Like, maybe you can't get a piece of music, listen to it, and be able to say that's 48 beats per minute. But if you say, oh, that feels really expansive and luscious and delicious and slow, then that's absolutely the most important part of that conversation.
Totally. And I think the benefit of like having language for it, even though it doesn't at the end of the day matter what language you're using, like you could use French, you could use German, you could just say it in plain English, but you know, make it descriptive. I think one thing that is really awesome about music notation is the economy of like sort of the economical way that space is used to convey a lot of information. Like I think like on a score, the words that have developed sort of the designations that sort of can both mean a tempo rough range, but also like a mood. Like I feel like it's so effective and efficient. You know, like allegro immediately connotes like a feeling as well as sort of a lively tempo. And, you know, there are so many tempo terms, like really that was just scratching the surface, but yeah, it is worthy to, it's always worthy to think about, because things like melody and harmony are probably discussed more frequently in the context of music, classical music, film music, because they're kind of easier to grasp onto, I think. Time has to be experienced in time. And so it can be harder to incorporate, like to organize what you're listening to and make sense of it.
Yeah, I definitely think it's like a weird Western bias we have where we privilege the quantifiable over, because, you know, you can prove them or whatever. And we're so uncomfortable with anything else. So much so that we organize the importance of musical characteristics in ways that are really limiting and blind us to a lot more important aspects. And the cool thing about Star Wars music is not necessarily its complexity, although it is very complex. It's just like the sheer emotional range that
yes
you get to experience in the course of a couple hours is like it's all of the emotional range one experiences in life, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think in Star Wars discourse specifically, I think the conversation around music is very, very focused on the themes, the leitmotifs. Like, I think that's where the conversation is amongst most fans, I would say. And as we move into an era without John Williams, and we hear different composers, you know, try scoring a Star Wars, we are hearing varying degrees of success, I would say. And it can be confusing because on one hand, it's like, well, we're getting themes though. And isn't Star Wars like about the themes? Like, I liked when that theme came in, but something about it still is either different or is not the same way somehow. And getting past the theme discussion is kind of the hardest part, but also I think where a lot of the answers lie.
Or even getting past the music discussion. You know, it's like,
yeah.
I was thinking about the way in which I think that we talk about sound and we talk about music as two different things, but they're both part of the soundtrack. And really what makes them different is not anything that has to do with the movie or what we're watching or listening to or consuming. It only has to do with the way in which we as listeners, as viewers, organize it in our brains, right? Like, we're like, okay, that's a real world sound and that's the oboe. And particularly in moments of this clip, and I mean, really the whole trilogy, that's a pretty arbitrary line to draw, right? I mean, you may not realize it because they're familiar sounds, you know, for example, the wind or a mechanical sound. You mentioned the door closing, which is as foreboding and ominous as any music ever. But it is really organizing the way in which you experience something, and it's organizing it through your ears. And that's something that I think really makes it very little different than the role of music.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to do some sort of like hearing test where, I don't know, one played varying things that are quote unquote music or sound, and then people had to guess, like, you know, categorize music, sound. This could get really, really wild if acousmatics stuff was introduced and whatnot. But I think the thing that Star Wars fans who are not musicians, one thing that I've heard them say quite a bit is that when listening to the Star Wars soundtracks, they're almost like, but where is this sound effect? Where's that? So like, they almost are thinking of it as like one whole soundtrack, or like they think it, the dialogue is missing, which dialogue is also a part of the soundtrack. The whole sandwich, you know, it's the whole thing together. And so, you know, that's why there are some fans that really wish that there was an audio version of the soundtrack, like the soundtrack as heard in the film, with all the dialogue, with all the sound effects, all the droid noises, all of that. Because for a lot of people, that whole package is what they remember, what's like burned into their memory from childhood.
Absolutely. And it's so weird to listen to something like a Spotify album of a suite of a, you know, cinematic work or something like that, because you realize how much stuff you fill in, like you said, how much extra musical information. And suddenly you realize things that you may have not caught before in the music, but also it's sort of disorienting. Like you feel that you're missing bits of the score, even though the score is pretty much all that's there, right?
Yeah. Do you like listening to film music just in general?
No, actually. I mean, I like watching films. Mm-hmm. I like thinking about the score in the context of the film. I really never ever sit down and just listen to a cinematic soundtrack. Probably for that exact reason. I mean, maybe some exceptions. I like some film movie musicals, you know, like I like the old Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers stuff from the 20s and 30s. I like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the Coen Brothers film, stuff like that, where sort of everything is compartmentalized. But in terms of something where there's a score that's integrated within the action, within the plot, within the sound effects, for me, it's just too weird. I would rather just sit down and watch the film.
Yeah, I think you're one of the first, if not one of the very few people who feels the same way about it as I do, which I don't.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't. I've said many times on the show that I'm not actually a soundtrack listener. So like for me, learning the names of the soundtrack, like I didn't even own any of the soundtracks. I just never listened to them because I just know it from the movie. And that's why this show is like about in the context of the movie, not just going track by track or cue by cue or theme by theme, which is another way to organize it. But I think that misses so much of the context of like the underscore that gets not ever talked about, or just how it's working in the context of the film. Like, I think that's the point of like a score, is it's a collaborative, you know, you're working toward a film. It's not just a soundtrack with tracks. I don't really enjoy just listening to soundtracks. And I find the experience very different from seeing it in the film. Sometimes for better and for worse. Sometimes I like despise the score when I see a film. But then listening to the soundtrack, I'm like, okay, the music's not bad. It just was a bad score for the film. And so.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I think too, there's the specifically with Star Wars, there's the kind of Wagner aspect, right? And like, I realize that Wagner is a problematic figure, you know, like raging anti-Semite and otherwise generally unpleasant human, but you really can't fully engage with the Star Wars soundtrack without talking about Wagner. And just so as a background, Wagner was an opera composer, very important opera composer, who believed that sound and visuals and space, even physical space, were all one and the same. They were all different facets of an experience that was listening to music, so much so that he designed a concert hall specifically for his music, so much so that he like put the orchestra kind of way further back in the pit than was ordinary, so that it produced this sort of unusual timbre, so much so that as a composer, he himself designed a lot of the sets and costumes, or at least was heavily involved in that process, which is very, very
not unlike George Lucas.
For an opera composer. Not unlike George Lucas. And then there's some other musical parallels, you know, like we've used the word leitmotif a couple times. That was something that was a Wagnerian concept of assigning a sort of snippet of melody or a melody to a character or a theme. This idea of having music happening essentially all the time, this endless, you call it endless melody, which applies to a lot of areas of Star Wars. So which is all just a very long-winded way of saying that I would never poo-poo somebody for listening to a film soundtrack. I mean, I'm not saying that that's the wrong way to engage with the music at all. I'm just saying that for me personally, I can't really separate any of those elements. I mean, for me, they're just, they're one organism of an experience.
Yes. Yes. And likewise, I think for some people listening to a soundtrack is a very enriching experience. And actually, Frank Lehman has written an article that I'll put in the show notes, but it's sort of about film music as a, not just as a medium that exists outside, like, I don't know, the film music as concert music or something about, like, I don't know. I'm not describing it. Oh, film as concert music. Okay. I'm finding it right now. What does it mean for film music to be plucked from its intended context and placed at the forefront of listeners' attention? And so he kind of talks about how film as concert music presents hearing cinematically as a valid alternative to structural modes of listening, a form of hearing that subverts both naive formalism and reflexive anti-formalism. And he kind of talks about, like, how listening to film as concert music, and I would say by extension as soundtracks, can then inform how you then view the films. And it can be, like, it's not like a music, real music people don't listen to soundtracks. There are formal implications for both modes of listening. And yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes to people who are interested in that.
Essentially, it becomes two different works, I think, is what it boils down to.
I think so too. Yeah. And literally, like, if you listen to this, you get stuff that's not in the movie. So it's you're getting, like, a different, it's like you're hearing the movie as it exists in a different timeline, almost. And then especially when we get to consider things like how the order is sometimes jumbled, where, like, the hits will, like, kind of just be, will be first and not really be in order of the sound of the actual movie. That's a thing as well. Complicated topic. Very complicated topic. Soundtracks are, and in Star Wars, there are so many versions of soundtracks. It's a whole mess. It's a whole mess. But anyway, okay, before we end, I want to run down the themes, cues, and soundtrack stuff again. So just to review, the themes that we heard in this set of minutes were just the Force theme, and maybe potentially a hint of the main theme, maybe. The cues are the very end of of 2M1, Luke's escape, and almost the entirety of 2M2, which is called Ben's instructions. And then in the soundtrack, this is the Wampa's Lair / Vision of Obi-Wan / Snowspeeders Take Flight. Gotta love those titles.
That covers it.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you wanted to say about these minutes before I ask you the Star Wars Music Minute questionnaire?
All I'll say is that it's fun to talk about this with a different listener, because I've learned a lot from your take, for sure.
And likewise, I love hearing different people's take on things. Well, then we'll move on to the Star Wars Music Minute questionnaire. This is the same set of three questions that every guest answers, mostly for fun, but also just to collect a variety of things and kind of get how different people listen to music and conceive of things. The answers to question number one in particular have been so fascinating to see the huge variety in question number one, which is, in exactly three words, what does Star Wars sound like?
I hate sand. No, I'm kidding. Unproblematic intergalactic Wagner. That's my final answer.
That's funny. Yeah, I like that. Never gotten that one. Question number two, what is something related to Star Wars music or sound that you want to learn more about?
Definitely the Foley work. Definitely the Foley work. The people in the room essentially figuring out, like, you know, how to make wind, how to make Darth Vader breathing noises, you know, how to make Chewie sounds. Well, I guess probably some dude made the Chewie sounds, but, you know, all of the stuff that isn't the music. I think, yeah. I have a pretty good handle on that, but I would have loved to be in the room where, you know, all these people experimenting with absurd objects to make cool sounds. That would have been fun.
There are many good stories that I've heard, and I wish that we had like a full history of every single sound, but
special episode maybe.
Yeah. That would require a research mission and possibly an interview. If I could get an interview with Ben Burtt, that would probably never happen, but that would be amazing. So final question is, what is a score or soundtrack that you're fond of besides anything Star Wars?
Okay. I have a running list on my phone actually, but I have to say, I'm sure you've, this one's pretty unoriginal. I'm sure that this one's come up before, but because it is absolutely closest to my heart next to Star Wars, the Lord of the Rings soundtrack for me is just, it's very different in some ways, but, the way it just perfectly grasps the emotional content of what you're viewing, the way, it goes above and beyond in being part of the narrative is just really, really makes it, I think, one of the finest soundtracks ever.
Awesome. Would you say like just Lord of the Rings, the first one, or just sort of the trilogy?
I think the trilogy. Yeah, I guess I hadn't really thought about parsing them out.
That's all right.
I think you'd need to give me another few weeks to figure it out. Definitely we'll forget about the Hobbit movies, and I don't really want to talk about the Amazon series in terms of music, but
fair enough.
We'll go with the original three.
Cool. I think everyone who has given Lord of the Rings as their answer has also said, but the Hobbit, not the Hobbit. So that's pretty funny. Finally, do you have any work online or places online that people can find your work or follow you or whatnot?
Sure. I've started writing pretty recently for Early Music America. If you're into pretty much the opposite of all of this, which is the kind of music people made like when they were still dying of the bubonic plague, then you can find some of my stuff trickling out on earlymusicamerica.org or com, or you know, just
something
Google
like
it.
That. Cool.
Something like that.
Nice.
Maybe move on from there. We'll see.
I forgot to mention, well, you're a Baroque music specialist, right? Or Renaissance as well?
Yeah. Early music, generally stuff before like 1700, probably 1750. So I play all sorts of very weird string instruments that nobody alive plays really. So.
Including viola da gamba, right?
Viola da gamba, some medieval fiddle. Let's see, I played a medieval hurdy-gurdy for about 4 hours one day. I can't say I would master at it, but there's not a lot to it. but yeah, that's the main thing.
That's awesome. Yeah, definitely the opposite. Not the opposite, but very different from this. awesome. Well, that's cool that you're writing for them. Yeah, I'm definitely going to check that out. And I'll put links in the show notes to all of this stuff. And listeners, we'll be back next week to talk about minutes 16 through 20. As always, let me know on Twitter or TikTok or email or Instagram or whatever if you have any questions. I'm not the best at like checking some of the social media platforms regularly, but if you have a question, the fastest way is to ask me on Discord. Link in the show notes for how to join that. But otherwise, that's all I have for today. May the Force be with you, and thanks for listening to Star Wars Music Minute.